You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Jemima Houston tōku ingoa, nō mai haere mai, ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Wednesday, the 19th of January. My name is Jemima and I'm your host and I'm joined in studio by Christina. How are you going?
Hey Jemima, good to be back.
Good to be back. It's the first Wednesday Wire back after the break, so we're all very excited to be back. It's been a little bit of a hectic day, hasn't it? But we're here. Which
we
is good.
Pulled it all together.
Christina's just like smashed it with multiple interviews, so it's been amazing. And we've got Alan as well for Dear Science. How are you going today?
Oh yes, all good.
All good. Yeah, we're just back rolling into it. It's good. It's a bit hot in here with our weird air conditioning system, but that's okay. Ifai Akine, coming up on the show today, we have some good stuff coming up for you.
So first of all, we start off with Dear Science, the first one for 2022, with Alan Blackman live in the studio for the first show of our year. So today we talk about the link between cataracts and dementia, the one we left off on last year, the nutritional value of hoo-hoo bugs, and a clue on Mars that could hint at past life on the planet. Exciting stuff.
Very interesting start to the year. I speak to ACT Party Deputy Leader Brooke Van Velden about her party's goals for 2022, the inevitable Omicron outbreak in New Zealand, and the Tonga volcanic eruption and tsunami disaster.
I also spoke to Dr. Xavier Walker from the University of Otago about the disaster in Tonga and the subsequent health impacts that can affect Tongans.
And as we said before, Christina's been very busy. She is also speaking with Associate Professor Leah Watkins about a recent study of marketing where researchers found children are exposed to one brand almost every minute. He aho ofakaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces. So tuku pātui mai, you can send us through a text on 5395 or wai mai rānei, give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Also, after the show, koe e wariwari. E ahi ana koutou, te whakarongo ke e nei kōrero anō, hei pakihiri roki roki, māronga i te pai, tuku tuku, o irarangi poho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. We podcast everything after the show, so I don't know, if you've tuned in halfway through on another wire and you were wanting to hear the whole piece, it's there. It's just on the website. So do check that out if you're interested. Let's crack into the show.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Welcome back to the show, Alan. I hope you had a wonderful break.
All too short, obviously. And Jemima was just doing things like a seasoned professional there. That was just fabulous. Absolutely fabulous.
Yeah, I wish you could see this in the studio. That is something else. I mean, I've just had a quick question. This isn't even related, but as a scientist, like when you're on holiday, can you turn it off? Like, can you just look at a car and see a car rather than like a system of
scientific invention?
Well, I got to say that a lot of the public seem to think that university finishes in around about October and starts again at about March, and we do nothing in between, which couldn't sadly be more wrong. No. So, yeah, no. No, you can't really turn it off. Not really.
No,
there's always something to do.
So. Yeah. Cool. So we've got some cool stories today in the world of science. First of all, like we mentioned before, there is a link between cataracts and dementia. So what exactly is that link and what does that mean for us?
Yeah, that's really interesting. And again, something I never knew about. God, I learn a lot when I do this show. I really do. You know, it's fabulous just sort of trawling the stories and finding all these things that I knew nothing about. So you're absolutely correct. There does appear to be a link between dementia and cataracts. And so it's a bit of a downer topic to start off the year with, I guess. But we talk about Alzheimer's disease, which is a disease of the brain. Dementia is just sort of a general sort of catch-all term for gradual loss of brain function and stuff. And we still don't know how Alzheimer's is caused. We still don't know the cause behind dementia, etc. So a lot of people are doing a lot of studies in this area because obviously it's very, very important. And what they have known or have found out is that there does appear to be some link between sight loss and the development of dementia. So if your sight is going, then you seem to be at higher odds of developing dementia than if you've got perfect vision. So there were some workers at the University of Washington who decided to investigate this and see if there was in fact any link between patients having cataracts and, or not, not and, or glaucoma, and to see how at risk they were of developing dementia and see if there was any relationship between the two things.
Oh, wow.
So there was a study that was started way back in the 1990s of around about 3,000 people aged 65 or over, and they, all of the participants had either cataracts or glaucoma. And what they did was they studied this cohort over 8 years, and they found that the people who had had the operation for cataracts, who'd had their cataracts cured by operation, had 0.7 the rate of development of dementia than those who either had glaucoma or didn't do the operation for cataracts.
Oh, wow.
So there's a definite... Well,
so you're better off if you get the operation for cataracts,
yeah,
is sort of the idea of this.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. And the thing with glaucoma is it's not a sight loss disease. The same amount of light is still getting in your eye and into the back of your eye and into your brain. Whereas the cataracts, the actual cataracts are stopping light getting into the back of your eye and into your brain.
Mm.
And so they've had a good think about this, and, you know, why should there be some sort of link between the whole cataracts and dementia thing? So there's two proposals that they've put up. The first is that because the cataracts stop light getting through, then you're getting lower quality visual information or visual stimulus to your brain.
Right.
And so that could possibly be a cause, the quality of visual stimulus that you're getting. Or the other thing is that cataracts are well known to absorb blue light preferentially.
And okay, that's so related to dementia.
Well, very possibly, because apparently our absorption of blue light allows our circadian rhythms to keep going, essentially. So we know when it's time to go to bed, we know when it's time to wake up. Our whole 24-hour thing apparently is determined by the amount of blue light that reaches our eyes. And again, that's why they've got the blue light thing on iPhones and stuff like that.
Mm. Okay. Oh, yeah, the
blue light glasses as well.
Yes.
So they're thinking that that might be it as well, that the cataracts are disrupting your circadian rhythms, and there seems to be some sort of link between poor sleep, bad circadian rhythms, and dementia. So, you know, this, I guess it answers a question, but it probably sort of poses some more. But there does seem to be this link between cataracts and dementia, vision and dementia.
Yeah.
So for goodness sake, you know, honestly, if you've got cataracts out there, I hate to say it, but it would be a really, really good idea to have the operation and get that done. Yeah,
and it's a wonderful starting point for some really interesting research that can be done. Oh, God.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely fascinating stuff. Really, really cool.
Yeah. Speaking of fascinating and a little bit gross, I received this slightly surprising email from you this morning, actually. It was about the hoo-hoo grubs.
Oh, indeed.
So you should see Jemima's face right now. Basically, University of Otago researchers have started analysing the nutritional value of these insects. What can you tell us about that?
Oh dear. Okay, I think probably the worst thing I've ever eaten was when I was in China and got served up locusts.
Oh yeah.
Oh, buggies.
Yeah, they're not really...
crunchy?
They're like wet cardboard. They're just hard to get down. But I was at a very important person's place for dinner, so yeah, I had to get them down. Anyway, but hoo-hoo grubs. Okay, so we all know hoo-hoo bugs, the actual beetles and stuff like that, those big suckers. And they are formed from hoo-hoo grubs, which you've probably seen as well. And if you've been to the Hokitika Wild Foods Festival, very possibly you might well have sampled them. Apparently they taste like peanut butter.
Yes.
There's no
apparently.
Way.
Apparently. You know this.
Wow.
You've tried them, Jemima.
I was going to say that I have an anecdote regarding the hoo-hoo grub.
Anecdote
away. My uncle is a park ranger in Bottle Lake, Forest down in Christchurch, mm-hmm. and he believes wholeheartedly in the nutritional value of Huhu crops. He would absolutely stand by this. Mm-hmm. He loves them. He will like actively look for them, and just loves them. Agrees that they taste like peanut butter. I've watched him eat many in my life. Don't want to get involved myself. They're yucky as looking, but you know, good for him. He would stand by the study. So I'm intrigued to hear what they say.
I'm assuming they were cooked. Did we do the whole
thing? Yeah, did the whole vibe. Yeah, thing. I think did the whole thing. Definitely seen some raw ones be consumed in my life. So.
Well, okay, so you'll be thrilled to know that University of Otago researchers absolutely agree with the contention that these
can't
things
wait
are good.
Tell
I'll be so excited.
So they were known to be high in fat, but they've also now, thanks to Otago, been found to be very high in protein. And in fact, higher in protein than beef, lamb, chicken, soy, and chickpeas.
Wow.
So around about 25 to 30% of the weight of a huhu grub is protein. So, and it's also got lots of trace elements, so manganese, magnesium, phosphorus, iron, copper, and zinc. So it's good in that as well.
Wow.
And if you're thinking of swapping over and getting your daily protein from huhu grubs, you'd only have to eat 75 a day.
to get
the same amount of protein that you would from a 230 gram slab of steak. And I think I know which one I'd be going for.
But it is like, you know, there is a lot of conversation about us moving towards eating insects, isn't that? That's where we're meant to be going.
Yeah.
Because that's more sustainable, right?
I suppose really if huhu grubs,
if huhu grubs are going to provide you with such sustenance, then perhaps that's a thing. I don't know. Maybe there's a good way to cook them. I don't know.
But if everyone's going to eat 75 huhu grubs a day, that's going to be a hell of a lot of huhu grubs.
That is a hell of a lot.
I've got to say, I don't really see a hell of a lot of huhu beetles out my way. I live out in Tararangi, so there should be heaps out there, and you don't really see that many. So it might be a nice idea in theory, but, you know, maybe in practice. I don't know. Anyway, just putting it out there, they are good for you, seemingly. So if anybody's brave enough to whip one on the barbie, then
somebody's just texting saying I've eaten a scorpion and it tastes very nutty.
Ooh.
And I've also eaten a cricket and that tastes a little peppery. Oh, and chocolate covered ants. I can imagine the chocolate for me is the like the only bit that would get me through that.
That is
brave. That's all I'll say. Brave.
What a wonderful text to receive.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's move away from this because Jemima's looking a little bit sick.
Oh yeah.
So finally, there has the Curiosity rover has been roaming around Mars since 2012.
Absolutely.
And recently, they've found a little clue that might hint at past life on Mars.
Well, you know, as David Bowie famously questioned way back in, 19, whenever it was, 71 or 69, is there life on Mars? We still don't know the answer to that. There may have been life on Mars, and that's part of the reason why the Curiosity rover is up there doing its thing. And so what they have found is that they've done some really nice experiments on this. So this little rover's driving around, it's drilling into the rocks, it's taking these samples, it's converting them to methane, and then it's analysing them, for goodness sake. It's hard enough to do on Earth, for goodness sake.
Wow.
And this thing's 80 million kilometres away, give or take, depending where we are in our rotation. And they can do this. It's just extraordinary what they can do. Anyway, so they're analysing carbon. And carbon contains isotopes. Right, quick test, what's an isotope?
I shouldn't do this because I'm a chemist. I've had a discussion with you about isotopes before, and I don't know.
There's something to do with protons in the nucleus.
Oh yes. Right. There's something to do
I've
with that. Yes.
Posted this show enough to learn something.
Good. Yeah. So it's all to do with the number of protons and the number of neutrons in the nucleus. Okay, so carbon exists basically as two isotopes. So we've got a light one and we've got a heavy one. Mm. And we call them carbon-12 and we call them carbon-13. Mm-hmm. And the only difference is that the carbon-13's got one extra neutron in the nucleus. Other than that, they behave pretty much exactly the same.
Right.
Other than the fact that when you form a chemical bond to a light carbon, it is easier to break than a chemical bond to the heavy carbon.
Mm.
Okay, now the heavy carbon is present in about 1 in 100 atoms, roughly, so about 1%. So okay. 99% of the time you're talking the light carbon, 1% you're talking the heavy carbon.
Mm-hmm.
Now, good old life, nature, biology, et cetera, et cetera, when it comes to making its molecules of life and converting them to other molecules of life, et cetera, et cetera, it likes to go the easy route. So it wants to go with the low energy breaking bonds. Okay, mm-hmm. So it's going to break bonds preferentially to the light carbons. And what that does is that enhances the amount of light carbon at the expense of the heavy carbon. So essentially, if you see this difference in the ratio between light and heavy carbon, that's a sign of life. Okay, which is, not to put too fine a point on it, what they found on Mars, essentially. Okay, so they're seeing this difference in the ratio. They're seeing more light carbon, less heavy carbon. So the ratio of heavy to light is, of light to heavy is greater than it is
and
on
Earth. And is that sort of evidence of like breaking down matter
yes,
or something?
Yes, exactly.
So
exactly
like
right.
If
yes.
there was yep. a thing there, it's
yes.
broken down.
Yep.
And that's what those light. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So that's why they say that it's an example possibly of life, sort of a sounding board for the presence of life.
Wow.
Whereas sort of all of these non-biological processes involve carbon, they really don't discriminate, or they don't discriminate as much as life does.
Mm.
So that's what they found on the good old Curiosity rover, and they're thinking, yes, it's a distinct possibility. There are other explanations that it could have passed through an interstellar cloud, and the carbon in interstellar clouds apparently is enriched in the light carbon as well. So that could have all, so many things to,
so many possibilities.
It's not an absolutely diagnostic experiment, but it's, again, as all of these things are, very, very interesting. And obviously the good old rover is going to keep on doing its thing up there and, getting more evidence either for or against the fact that life did perhaps once exist on Mars.
Amazing.
It's very cool.
So there we go. A shame
so
David
cool.
Bowie wasn't around to hear this.
To know.
Yes, he died, last week, I think, or 1 or 2 weeks ago and... in 2016, I think it was,
yeah.
So it's just gone the anniversary.
Very timely then. That's good.
Yeah, there we go.
Cool. Anyway, that's all the time we have for Dear Science today, but I really appreciate you coming in and kicking off 2022 with some very interesting facts as
definitely.
Usual.
Definitely. Yeah, amazing as per.
Oh, you're too kind, goodness.
Well, we will catch you next time.
Absolutely. Cool. See you guys. Again.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
You're on The Wire on 95BFM. We will be right back with some more good newsy bits for you after this.
What's a seven-letter word for Street Fighter?
Seven. It could be another clue. Lust, envy... You can expect 5 more of these.
Okay, what about treasure trunks in 6?
California, stay away from here. Don't come in here now. Whatever you do, stay away.
Shit, you're useless. Don't you know anything?
I know, but tonight at Ponsonby Social Club there is.
Batika Beats with Enrique Morales, Miguel BD and Lance Bentley, plus DJ Bobby Brazuca.
What's on tomorrow?
A live tribute to Catronata featuring Avondale Bowling Club and Yokozuna members, followed by DJs Bobby Brazuca and Marjorie Sinclair.
Same old Ponsonby Social Club, 152 Ponsonby Road.
Do people think I'm a wimp?
Why? Because you're a plant-based yogurt.
Yeah, because I'm plant-based.
Nah, you're just really easygoing in your own special way.
I am, right? Once you get to know me, I'm pretty flex and fruity.
Fulfill your flexitarian dreams with Little Island's plant-based yogurt. Low in sugar, but high in calcium and probiotics. It's also, get this, extremely delicious.
Flex and fruity.
Little Island plant-based yogurt. Available in natural, vanilla, berry and summer fruits. Go to littleislandcreamery.co.nz.
Wow, wow. Music's everywhere. It's like a cloud of art.
Here at 95BFM, we've sucked up some of the best contemporary bangers, bottled them and chucked them into a special Spotify playlist just for you.
Our Best of 2021 playlist is up now. Join us in celebrating the music that got us through.
Follow 95BFM on Spotify for a monthly Spotify playlist and stay au fait.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with ACT Party Deputy Leader Brooke Van Velden.
It is that time again, the Wednesday Wire. We always chat to ACT Party Deputy Leader Brooke Van Velden as part of our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party. We obviously catch up with the rest of the parliamentary parties on different days of the week. So if you are a bit of a political nut and you are interested in hearing some of the latest political news from the people who are in those parliamentary seats, then do tune into The Wire because we chat to these people regularly. So yes. But anyway, today, for my first conversation with Brooke of the year, we had a little bit of a chat about the ACT Party's goals for 2022. We also talked about the Omicron variant being on the doorstep here in New Zealand and the very inevitable outbreak that will happen in the community here, and also about the volcanic eruption and tsunami disaster in Tonga. I began by asking Brooke about the ACT Party's goals for 2022.
Well, our goal really is to make sure that we are giving a voice to New Zealanders and making sure that we are part of a democracy that listens to the concerns that New Zealanders actually have and face in their lives. And I know that from going around the country, even this summer, but in the previous year, more and more New Zealanders are saying to us that they're feeling like this is a divisive country. They're not being able to freely express their views, but they feel like the government is not actually listening to their concerns. And starting off this year, the ACT Party is concerned about the rising cost of living. We're seeing more borrowing and spending, taxing and regulating coming from the government, and we're seeing prices going up. We know people were going to be expecting higher inflation this year. We also know rental prices are going up. It's more expensive to get petrol in your car. Childcare costs are becoming much harder for people when they're looking at what next dollar should they spend their next thing on. And so the ACT Party is asking the government to hold back on wasteful spending and making sure that we actually have a better COVID plan going into this year, so that our plan isn't to borrow billions of dollars and see costs of living going up.
So let's talk a little bit more now about COVID. As you've just mentioned, obviously this is an ongoing issue and it's looking like it will continue for some time yet. The big issue now, and that's sort of been reported on a lot over our wee summer break, is that Omicron is on the doorstep. We're just waiting for it to outbreak in the community in a serious way. And I understand today that the government is meeting to discuss the traffic light system, and we're going to have a plan for Omicron appear in the next coming weeks. How is the ACT Party feeling about this Omicron outbreak?
Well, I think that the best thing that we're hearing from the government recently is that they're acknowledging that Omicron will actually reach New Zealand. I don't think it's right that up until this point, we have not seen the government actually plan and prepare for what COVID in our community would actually look like. And you don't have to go too far back into the past to see that when Delta came only a few months ago, the government had no plan whatsoever that was different from what we had seen in March 2020. The plan was simply to lock everyone down and try and lock COVID out. So what we actually need from the government is to know what the plan is. We need a smarter solution going forward.
Well, what could that solution possibly be? Because obviously we are in sort of an interesting position here in New Zealand, and we have experienced the same sort of thing when there's been a new variant, that we're isolated and it doesn't come to us as quickly as other bigger countries. And we're seeing overseas that there are just massive numbers of Omicron cases, and they are just jumping up and jumping up, and people are entering the hospital system because of how infectious this this new variant is. What is the solution that isn't going into lockdown? Because how are we going to stop people from transmitting the virus?
Well, I think we need to be clear that it's going to be very hard to stop people transmitting the virus. Like you said, it is very infectious. So it will spread through the community as soon as it reaches through the border to New Zealand. But we need to have a plan that is about the least harm. We haven't actually seen a plan about how we keep the most vulnerable people protected when it comes to our community. We've seen the government say that we can now have boosters, but the boosters haven't been proactively put into the arms of people who are the most vulnerable. And so we need to be seeing people who are, you know, at a higher health risk being given the vaccine boosters first. But we also need to have a plan for what isolating our most vulnerable people could potentially mean, having home isolation kits.
Right. So let's move on to talking a little bit about Tonga. Really devastating and horrendous news about the volcanic eruption in Tonga and the lack of communication that's been able to be had with the Tongan public and the Tongan government. I know that Parliament is on leave at the moment, but have there been sort of discussions amongst MPs about what is New Zealand's response to a disaster like this, to one of our closest Pacific neighbours?
Yeah, well, firstly, I'll just say that my thoughts are going out to the people of Tonga and the people who have family and friends in Tonga, and they haven't actually heard from them. And I know that would be hugely stressful for anybody in that situation. When it comes to the disaster response in New Zealand, I think it has been lacking. We saw the government come out with a statement at their press conference that they were waiting to send help because they were waiting to hear what Tonga needs. And I just don't think that that's good enough. You know, our foreign affairs policy and strategy is to be a friend and ally to the Pacific and for Pacific aid. That is our grand strategy. If we can't answer a basic question of what do we send to a disaster zone in a disaster in the Pacific, when that is part of our greatest foreign affairs strategy, we have a real problem.
In fairness, there was difficulties in determining how we could possibly get there in relation to there being the massive ash cloud causing issues for flights and then not really knowing what anything was going to look like on the ground or in the water. So do you think that's potentially why that wait came about?
I think there was a potential need for a wait to make sure that we had the people who were ready to go to help. I don't think it is justifiable that you have the defence minister putting out selfies of himself in the gym, finishing his set and saying that he's waiting for more advice. I think that was a bit of a low blow for the people of Tonga. But there are basic things that are always needed in a disaster. You need tarps, food, water, medicine, and you need people on the ground to help the people of Tonga.
That was ACT Party Deputy Leader Brooke Van Velden speaking about the ACT Party's goals for 2022, the inevitable Omicron outbreak, and also about the Tonga volcanic eruption and tsunami disaster.
That was Deputy Leader Brooke Van Velden from the ACT Party.
You're on the Wednesday Wire on 95BFM with Jemima and Christina. We'll be back with another couple of pieces for you. But first, here is Dark Taste by Thorndales.
Bathroom by myself. Relationships with their girlfriends or their wife. No one, they shouldn't have more than one wife at a time.
You're back on The Wire with Jemima and Christina. The recent volcanic eruption and tsunami in Tonga have raised massive concerns for the health and well-being of Tongans. The disaster has raised immediate health concerns as well as potential long-term impacts on both physical and mental health. I spoke to Dr. Xavier Walker from the Medicine Department at the University of Otago about these issues and the ability of Tonga's health system to cope with this. So with the Tongan volcanic eruption and subsequent tsunami over the weekend, there are bound to be immediate health concerns for those affected by the eruption. What can you tell us about most pressing threats to the health of Tongans right now?
Thanks very much. Just want to convey my thoughts for Tonga and the people and healthcare workers going through this very difficult time. Obviously, there's different layers of things that people will be thinking of in the health system. And the first, which we're going through right now, is the acute health management. So that's really providing any care that's needed for people after these two disasters. Unfortunately, they've had two back-to-back or associated, one being the volcanic eruption and two being the tsunami. So immediate things with the volcanic eruption, one would think about is that all the gases that have been emitted from the volcano, and as we've seen from those pictures from the surveillance, all the ash. So immediately, obviously, is any lung exposure and eye exposure. So those most at risk will be people with health conditions such as asthma or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and also may put pressure on people with ischemic heart disease or heart problems. So it would be important for those sort of people to Obviously, sit metal retention, stay indoors, reduce exposure from ash, and got involved to wear a mask. So I'm not too sure what the state of play is with availability of masks, but that would be important. And also if there's any things in the circulation as eyewear. And also for people involved with the cleanup, so obviously they're, say, cleaning up the airport so planes can land, that people have adequate protection wear. So lung and eyes would definitely be a thought process. As we've been seeing, water is crucial. So with all that exposure from the ash, it's very important that that the Tongans have safe drinking water. So and that there's availability for testing. So anything that needs to be tested for the different levels. So there's no toxins and what's there. There'll also be damage to crops, as we said, with the ash in there. And as we know, one of the big things that is emitted from a volcano is sulfur dioxide, and that can turn to sulfuric acid in the atmosphere, and that causes what we call acid rain. And acid rain can fall and damage crops and water sources. So it's important that anything is washed thoroughly and measures going out. And that's not only just for Tonga, I see that it's also for Fiji. They're doing health measures for that. The other things that we also would be important going long-term would be any psychological effects. We know with any disaster, whether we think about the Christchurch earthquake, the World Trade disaster, the tsunami in Indonesia, there is psychological effects from that, and that's important that that Tongans have the ability to manage that, and that may be a long tail in terms of monitoring that and any future repercussions. There is not a lot of studies on long-term effects of volcanic eruptions, but a lot of the data comes from Iceland because they've had a long history of hundreds of years of repeated volcanic eruptions. So one thing they have done is developed a directory of health, and I think it's been going for about 10 or 15 years, and that may be something that would be useful, is to have longitudinal research done to ensure that the health of Tongans is monitored. So it's really important that the vulnerable populations are taken care of. So this will be children that, you know, that they have limited exposure, pregnant ladies, females, and also any elderly that might have difficulties. The other thing we need to be concerned about is any damage to the infrastructure with the healthcare system itself. So we have the immediate, obviously, effects of the volcano and the tsunami, but there has been disruption to the communication system for Tonga, the transport system. So transporting patients to the hospital, to the healthcare settings, and between the island groups. Tonga has three or four main island groups, and a lot of that is either by plane or boat, but you have to make a decision where when people are transported out. So that's important that the communication system is able to get back up and running, and also the effect of the actual healthcare system itself. You're still got to run a healthcare system, so it's sort of multiple different things we're thinking about.
With a disaster on this scale, how prepared was Tonga's health system to cope with this on top of an ongoing pandemic as well?
Yes, you bring up good points. Tonga's done very well. From my understanding, they had had very, very few cases of COVID and reasonable vaccination rates. But then, you know, it's important that vaccination still occurs, the rollout to children, because they've got a very youthful population. Tonga and all the islands are no strangers to natural disasters, but most of them have been like cyclones and hurricanes. So they actually have infrastructure, they have management systems, and probably better than a lot of people, knowing how to manage these sort of disasters. The people themselves are very resilient people and know how to work with that. So there has been, over the years, a lot of disaster training and planning. I think no one's really, like we know from our experience with White Island, no one's really trained to deal with a volcano eruption. So that, I imagine, was one that, you know, it would throw a lot of health systems off. But there are international guidelines, there are expertise which can go into play, and there's a lot of the different networks, and also reaching out to New Zealand and Australia and aid partners. There's different protocols on things, but I imagine Tonga has the systems in place, and it's just really getting support that they need and that's appropriate.
That was Dr. Xavier Walker from the University of Otago speaking to me about the health consequences of the crisis in Tonga and what it means for the health system.
Thank you so much for that one, Christina. You're on the Wednesday Wire. We'll be right back with another piece after a little break.
Oh, how did you see her
fascinate? A toast to that perfect blend of comfort, protection, and breathability. Yes, I'm wearing socks and sandals right now. The wool, the leather, it's enough to make you feel a little animalistic. Yeah. Yeah.
Shaky Isles Coffee, brewed different for soiree sophisticates and footwear fanciers. Go to shakyisles.co.nz.
Seabiscuit's a wanker. Black Beauty's been checked out since 96. Farlap's dead and Australian.
But there are still some equine chums who know how to show you a bloody good time. Pony Ping Pong on 95BFM. Every Friday night, Matt and Aaron are here to blast open your weekend with a mix of mashdowns, candid convos, cheap shots, and mystery celebrity nakedness. Pony Ping Pong. Friday, 9 to 11pm, only on 95BFM.
At this radio station, we do our utmost to abide by the Broadcasting Standards Authority and their rules and guidelines. If you seriously think we've crossed the line on air, give us a call on 309 4831 within 20 working days of the broadcast date and tell us about it. We'll be able to help you out and tell you the procedure if you wish to make a formal complaint to the Broadcasting Standards Authority. Fuck knuckles, cock and piss. Balls. Thank you.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
It's no secret that advertising is a huge part of our day-to-day lives, even when we're not actively consuming. And concerningly, it seems many children are now frequently exposed to the oversaturation of brands and marketing in our lives. A new study has found kids are exposed to 554 brands a day, which is almost one brand every 60 seconds. The study, conducted by researchers at the University of Otago, is the first to look at children's exposure to marketing on a daily basis. This morning, I spoke with Associate Professor Leah Watkins, who co-led the study.
So it's great to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me.
So this study is the first bit of research to show us just how much advertising kids are exposed to these days. So first of all, how did you execute this study?
So we collected the data by asking children of intermediate age, so 11 to 13-year-olds, to wear a camera. So it was placed around their neck, so about chest height, and the camera captures an image every 7 seconds of exactly what they are seeing. So it's about 180 degrees in front of them that it captures.
What are the main results that we can see? So where are kids seeing the most advertising and branding?
So I think what we can see, I mean, for me, one of the most important things is just getting the big number of how many they are seeing. And we were interested in that from a sort of, I guess, a more planetary health perspective. So not what are children being encouraged to consume, but just that they're being encouraged to consume full stop. So some of my work has been around how we socialise children as consumers, and the ethics of marketing to children, and how children develop advertising literacy. And so a lot of that literature recognises that it's not just about what we are advertising, but the fact that we are encouraging sort of the development of very materialistic attitudes and just a desire for things. So we wanted to know about that big number, that pervasiveness. And then within that, we wanted to know specifically what are the children seeing or what's being targeted to them in different environments. And surprisingly, they were seeing a lot in school. Now, obviously, that's because they spend a lot of time in school. But we were surprised just how much they were seeing in that environment. Obviously, their retail environments are exceptionally cluttered, but they don't spend a lot of their time in those environments. And a lot is what they're seeing at home. So that is obviously product labelling and also what they're seeing on screens.
Obviously, with this study being kind of the first in its field, would you be able to tell us if this is kind of a concerning increase in advertising that's aimed towards children?
As you say, we don't have a benchmark study to compare the numbers to, so I can't say definitely that it is increasing, but certainly the literature recognises that marketing is, and specifically marketing to children, is becoming more pervasive. So there are more mediums, there are different techniques, and I definitely think it's fair to say that children are exposed to a lot more marketing than they were, say, 10 or definitely 20 years ago.
And would digital technology play a role in this increase in advertising?
Yes, absolutely. The digital environment is one that I think we need a lot more research into. Obviously, it's difficult to measure, and in our own study, that's one of the limitations. We could sometimes see what the children were seeing on screen, but obviously it depended the camera angle and the lighting and things like that. So certainly it's an underestimation of what they're seeing online. And for that reason, we have just started a pilot study that will use software that they download onto their various devices that will be able to give us a much more accurate picture of what they're seeing online. And I think the online environment's interesting for several reasons. One, obviously, that they're spending a lot of their time on devices, so it's the number of ads, but also it's the nature of them, because obviously the social media environment is not regulated in the same way that, for example, billboards and television are subject to advertising standards. So I think what the products that they're seeing will be different. And also, of course, it's the style of advertising on social media. And we know that at that age, children are still developing their general media literacy and their advertising literacy. So arguably, they're more susceptible to that type of advertising. They recognise television, they're able to be critical about what they're seeing, but the same may not be true in a social media environment.
And this increased susceptibility of young people, it obviously plays a role in overconsumption. What other societal impacts that are potentially negative should we be worried about?
I think there's that big societal issue, which is the drive for overconsumption. There's the personal health and public health issues around what they are being targeted with, so those harmful products. And we define harmful as alcohol, tobacco, gambling, and non-core foods. So those are foods that the World Health Organization recommends are not marketed to children, things like sugary drinks, anything that has a nutrient profile that, you know, we would not be encouraging consumption of. So I think we need to think about regulation around harmful products. And also we need to think about, are there spaces in society that should be free of marketing? And, for example, schools. So obviously, as I mentioned, we're seeing a lot of exposure in school. And the literature around that does already highlight the ethical concerns around children in school. They're a captive audience, they're a vulnerable audience, and also there's some kind of implicit endorsement when they see an ad in school. So I think it's important to have discussions about specifically what are they seeing, and do we want to put some regulation around that.
Your study also looked at the impact of advertising in specific socioeconomic areas, for example. So how could marketing kind of exacerbate the inequities that already exist in society?
Yeah, it was definitely concerning for us to see that. It is a small sample, so we can't say anything categorically here, but certainly the trend was that in the lower socioeconomic households, and we used the measure of the NZDEP measure, that the children were seeing more unhealthy marketing. So there was no difference in terms of the total number that they were seeing, no significant differences, but the nature of that marketing was different. And as you say, that's really concerning. You know, we know that some of these health issues, so gambling harms, obesity, etc., we're worried about anyway in these within these socioeconomic groups. And so if they are disproportionately being targeted, with perhaps not being targeted as such, but just that their environments are such that they are exposed to more of that type of marketing, then again, I think that's an important discussion to be had.
Sorry. That was Associate Professor Leah Watkins speaking to me about a recent study showing the pervasiveness of advertising in the day-to-day lives of children.
That was The Wire.
That brings us to the end of the Wednesday Wire for another week. Big thank you to you for tuning in and listening to the show today. And a massive thank you as well to those of you who text in. We always love to hear from you. So keep those thoughts rolling in when you're listening to The Wire, because we love to hear feedback. Massive thank you to Christina for producing today. How do you feel it went?
I really enjoyed that one. Yay. Really enjoyed our little chats, especially with Ellen as usual. But I hope you all enjoyed the pieces today.
Yes, we really hope you enjoyed them, and we hope you're doing well out there and looking after yourself and enjoying the sun if you get a chance to. Today it is hot out there, so you know, wear your sunblock, but enjoy it while it lasts. Up next is The Wonderful with Bridge. We'll catch you with another Wire tomorrow at midday, and see you then. Ka kite anō.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.